Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, also on the internet at cjsf.ca, and tells HD channel 7014. It's a beautiful Monday afternoon here up at Simon Fraser University atop the mountain. Happy Easter to you all, if you celebrate it. Blessings from Ishtar, otherwise, Shalom, Mazel Tov, and everything else in between. And because it's the holiday, we are taking an alternative look at Easter and sort of more an academic look at Jesus. But don't worry, we are not having a religious discussion by any means at all. I've got two professors as guests today discussing different topics. The first is an author and poet, and he's a professor at Middlebury College in Vermont, and he has a new book called Jesus, the Human Face of God, which sort of it reexamines and, you know, reopens questions about the resurrection and the Gospels, and he says that if you read the four Gospels closely, there's no actual literal mention of a literal rising from the dead, as many Christians claim Jesus did. So, is the entire Bible, is the entire story of Jesus a giant metaphor? But he also says we can never know for sure. He is Jay Perini, and he'll be joining me live on the phone about 10 minutes from now. My second guest is all the way from Heidelberg, Germany. He is Professor Werner Arnold, and he is the chair of the Semitic Studies Department at the University of Heidelberg. And he is also an expert in Western Neo-Aramaic, which is the closest modern descendant to the language they spoke at the time that Jesus lived. The people of Galilee and Palestine and Nazareth. He also spent 2 years in Melulla, which is a village in northern Syria where it's the only place on earth where Aramaic is spoken on a regular basis, but it's in danger of becoming extinct thanks in part to the conflict in Syria. There was the Battle of Melulla in September 2013 between the rebels and the Syrian government. So Professor Arnold will talk to us about that and how he got into Aramaic, and also how a lot of it's been displaced not only by migration but also by the rise of Arabic and the Islam tradition. And my musical guest today was my very first guest back in Endeavors 4 years ago when we first premiered back in February of 2010. She is Jessica Beach, and she is here to talk about her new EP, Songs for Sadie. And we're going to start with the second track off that album. This is Sweetness.
I wasn't dreaming when I told you the things that made me jump up out of my skin.
My dreams, you said you'd save all of yours.
And that was Sweetness by Jessica Beach off her album Songs for Sadie. And you'll be hearing from Jessica a little later on in the program. But right now, I am joined on the phone by author, poet, professor at Middlebury College in Vermont, and author of the new book, Jesus, the Human Face of God. Jay Perini is on the phone with me now. Jay, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
So, your new book is...
Oh, that's a good question.
...is Jesus, the Human Face of God. Now, I understand that this book actually started as a work of fiction for you.
Yeah, I've written a lot of novels. I wrote the novel The Last Station that was made into
great
Academy
movie.
Award-winning film with Helen Mirren and Christopher Plummer playing Leo Tolstoy. And I do a lot of historical novels, and I thought I would be a great novel to write with Jesus told from the point of view of the four gospel writers and apostles, this kind of thing. Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
But then I was approached by a friend who's a publisher at Amazon.com and said, hey, we're going to do some biographies, and how would you like to write about some icon? I said, how about Jesus? And he thought I was crazy. He said, Jesus? So I said, yeah, Jesus. I want to write about Jesus. So it was quite a journey. For a year and a half, I plunged into rereading the Gospels. I had studied theology in college for a long time, and I'd read the Gospels in Greek 35, 40 years ago. So I dusted off my old Greek New Testament and started to make my way through it again, and just assembled this life of Jesus from things that I knew from, 40 years, 50 years of thinking about the subject.
Now, I know in the past some of your other biographies have included William Faulkner and Robert Frost. So,
right.
Jesus seems to be a little bit of a departure from that. How would you compare sort of your process to writing about a figure such as Jesus compared to somebody like Faulkner?
You can't even compare them. If I'm writing about William Faulkner or Robert Frost, I've done John. I wrote a nearly 1,000-page biography of John Steinbeck. So that's a very different kind of enterprise. This is a short book. It's 50,000 words. It's about 150 pages in print. And it's almost like, going into a deep meditation on the subject. Now, I am a regular church-going Christian, and I have a regular prayer and meditation practice. And I'm not writing out of, from the top of my head. This is something that I've been seriously thinking about for a very long time. But what I say in the beginning of the book is, look, this is what I'm trying to do is find the mythos of Jesus. Mythos is the Greek word for mythical story.
Yeah.
And I'm not a very fundamentalist sort of guy. I have a kind of an aversion to literalism, and I'm reading the story of Jesus as a great story which has deep applications to our lives, and it actually can have a kind of saving grace, if you will, but it's a very different take on the life of Jesus.
I mean, some might argue, the Bible exists, and that's the story of Jesus, so why would they go out and read your book when they can just read the Bible?
Well, what I'd say is, first of all, the Bible, the New Testament, the Gospels are the life of Jesus we have. They're written 2,000 years ago, in the meanwhile, in the last very short while, we've had an amazing amount of new information. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in the late 40s and the early 50s, giving us a vast amount of new information. Then you had the discovery of all these Gnostic Gospels in Egypt, giving us over 20 new Gospels. New Gospels, new material is found every day. Archaeologists have been exploring the old Palestine area and have uncovered amazing artifacts, dug up old cities. We know a great deal more about the kind of Judaism that Jesus would have confronted in his day, and we know just a lot more about what his life was like. So what I do in this book is just pull together all of the latest thinking about Jesus and the Gospels. And I combine it with my own interest in poetry and religion, and try to create a very readable life of Jesus.
One of the things that I found interesting when I was reading up on you is you talk about the resurrection and how what sort of the fundamentalists think of a literal resurrection probably wasn't actually the case, considering there's barely any mention of it in the four main Gospels. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I've written a couple times. I write a great length in the book about what the resurrection really entails. But I think you contacted me because over the weekend I was asked by CNN to write a meditation on Easter. And I wrote a piece about what is the resurrection. Was Jesus really, lifted up from the dead? And, it's been a fairly controversial piece. It had over 13,000 comments, and I've had hundreds of emails over the last 3 days. Some people seeming to be very angry with me, simply because I read the Gospels closely, and I noticed the fact that, in fact, we never in the Gospels see Jesus waking from the dead. What I say is that the resurrection was not the great resuscitation. Jesus was not. We don't see his eyes open. He just simply walked out of the tomb and he says, "Here I am, guys. I'm physically with you again." In fact, I do think that something happened dramatic and really totally marvelous and strange and wonderful and saving. But it wasn't simply a resuscitation. It was a transformation of a magical kind. And I point out that in all the Gospels, we have stories of how when people first encountered the resurrected Jesus, such as Mary Magdalene in the tomb on Sunday morning, she didn't know who he was. Here's Jesus' best friend, Mary Magdalene. He comes up to her, starts talking. She thinks he's the gardener. And finally, when he starts talking to her, and he says, "Mary," she says, "Oh my goodness, you're Jesus." Look at the case of the man on the disciples of Jesus, who are going from Jerusalem to Emmaus, a long, long walk. Yeah. And Jesus starts walking beside them. They converse for hours, and they don't know who he is. When he sits down to them to have dinner, they say, "Hey, please have dinner with us, stranger." He says, "Fine." And then he offers a prayer, and it's when he prays that they say, "Oh, my goodness, are you Jesus?" And you look at the gospel, look at what it says carefully. Poof, he disappears. So the vision is fleeting, very difficult to hold on to.
Yeah.
I think the Gospels suggest again and again that the resurrected Jesus is a very different entity from the old Jesus in the body. And I think that this tells us that the kind of eternal life that we will experience as Christians is something that we can't get our human brains around, but it's a transformation.
So where do you think this idea of a literal resurrection came from?
Well, people are very literal-minded, and it doesn't surprise me. People say, "Well, look, one day he was dead, the next day he's sort of alive, and even if people don't recognize him, he's there." I don't think people are willing to grapple with what such a magical transformation could mean. And, there's a terribly strong desire in us simply to read these great mythical stories as real stories. We want to read about God the Father. Yeah. We want to think of him as our dad up in heaven, a guy in a beard with a cloud. But, God is not sitting up on a cloud somewhere. It's not a spatial metaphor. If it is, God is a very interior God. In fact, Jesus is trying to explain these things to people when they say, "Well, where is this kingdom you're always talking about?" He says, "The kingdom of God is within you." And I think it's very difficult for us as human beings with very fragile minds to try to get our heads around anything as complicated as eternity, the meaning of life, or the kind of kingdom that Jesus might have been talking about.
One of the things that I saw that you wrote was that because it was so long ago, and I think there's a lot of ambiguity, and we can never really know for sure certain aspects about Jesus' life, correct?
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, think about it. This is written, Jesus died 2,000 years ago, roughly, give or take a few years. We don't know the exact date. And, you know, the first writings about Jesus appeared probably 20 years after his death, and those were the few surviving letters of St. Paul. He wrote maybe 13 or 14 letters. Only seven of them aren't really thought to be authentic letters of Paul. The others are sort of school of Paul. Then come along the first Gospels. The first one we actually have is the Gospel according to Mark. That's probably 50 years after Christ died. And then we have Matthew coming and Luke probably 70 years or so after the death of Jesus. The Gospel of John is possibly a century after the death of Jesus. So, you know, these works were written for various audiences. You know, somewhere around the second century, some bishops sat together and said, now, which of these Gospels that we have, and there must have been 20 or 30 of them, are the ones that we think are most useful, most authentic, have come closest to ideas of what Jesus might have been like, and they chose Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. And they discarded the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Philip, you know, the Gospel of Judas, and so forth. There were many, many Gospels. We actually have them now. The Gospel of St. Thomas is actually a marvelous Gospel, but it was discarded. And so, you know, Revelation comes from many different areas. We don't even know Mark's original Gospel, what he was drawing on. He was clearly drawing on some material that was there written previously, but we don't have that. So it's all surmise.
So then was Jesus, in your mind, a composite of many people who existed at the time? Was he a man that was made this deity by humans, or was he actually a miracle worker?
Well, there were a lot of miracle workers wandering around in Palestine in the beginning of the first century AD, or ACE, as they call it now. I think that there's no question that there was a person called Jesus Christ. Jesus, anyway, not Jesus Christ. Christ just, well, that's not his last name. That's just Christos, which is the Greek word for Messiah. There was somebody called Jesus. We have evidence of him. He's mentioned in some contemporary texts. Very briefly, he's mentioned in Tacitus, Suetonius, and Josephus. But really, there's very little contemporary, meaning in Jesus' time, evidence about him. I think there really was a man called Jesus. I think he had remarkable gifts. He was a religious genius. I think he was able to pluck from the West all kinds of ideas about metaphysics from Plato, body and soul. I think he was, you know, living on the Silk Road there, and he was able to speak to people who had come in from Persia and the East. So he understood something about karma and various ideas, mystical ideas. I think he had a unique, and I say unique, relationship with God, with the Spirit. I think he was a profound prophet and teacher. And I think it's possible that we can't understand, but I personally believe that he had such immense contact with God that he transcended the boundaries of time and space. And so his resurrection becomes entirely plausible. But so my belief is in an actual Jesus who was a man who became the Son of God through his own deep spiritual connection to God.
This book took you, you said, a couple of years to write. What did you learn about your own sense of spirituality in the writing process?
You know, the book was for me a spiritual journey. You know, I felt like here I am, a guy, you know, more or less toward the end of his life. You know, I can look at the calendar, I know the deal. And my whole life I've been interested in Jesus and religion, and I've studied Buddhism, and I've practiced some Buddhism. I'm interested, and I have no scorn for any religion. I think that there are many roads up the mountaintop, and that, you know, the view from the top would be spectacular, but I think you can get there many ways. Because I grew up in a religious Christian tradition, it was the most useful thing for me. I have deep affection. I spent 7 years in Scotland as a student, did my PhD at the University of St. Andrews. You know, I was a professor at Oxford, so I have a deep affiliation with Anglican traditions. I love T.S. Eliot. You know, I read the four quartets of T.S. Eliot every year, at least two or three times. So for me, it was a very useful and practical way to access the spirit and to develop my own sense of spirituality. So for me, this book was a journey of spirituality, self-discovery, a way of focusing, and coming to terms with things that I sort of vaguely knew, but now wanted to actually put down in language and come to understand in a deep way.
Well, the book is Jesus, the Human Face of God. You can visit Jay Perini at his website at jperini.com. Jay Perini, thanks so much for your time today, and best of luck in the future.
Well, thanks, and I appreciate your call.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
Yeah, thanks. Bye-bye.
And that was Professor Jay Perini, the author of Jesus, the Human Face of God, and he was in Vermont. Okay, we have a couple of announcements, and then we're going to hear another song from the lovely Jessica Beach. Out on campus, check it out. And now check out this song from Jessica Beach off her album Songs for Sadie. This is You'd Be So Lucky.
If I was your girl, I would whisper your name.
Jessica Beach, You'd Be So Lucky, off Songs for Sadie. Catch out her CD release party this Thursday at Joe's apartment. And now I spoke with Jessica last weekend on her new album, Pets and Children. Enjoy it. This one's for you, Jess. Well, well, well. In the studio with me is Vancouver's own Jessica Beach. Welcome.
Welcome. Hi, man. How's it going?
Good. I should say welcome back. Jessica was my very first guest over 4 years ago.
I was just thinking about that when I was sitting in the lobby waiting with my girls, and the last time I was here, they were still inside. I remember being here and being so pregnant, I wasn't supposed to go anywhere, but I was so bored that I came by and played some music on the other show that was happening.
Yes.
And they had a keyboard set up, and they kindly just invited me in, and we ended up having a bit of a spontaneous jam sesh.
Yeah, now that was about like a week before you became bedridden or something.
Yes. Yes, it was. I think technically at that point I still wasn't supposed to get up, but I did.
Anywho, the new album is Songs for Sadie.
It is.
About the late, great Sadie Beach.
Yeah, Sadie the Adventure Dog Beach.
Was this always something you had planned to do? Where did this album come from for you?
I definitely planned on releasing another record of originals, and I wrote some of those songs when I was pregnant. Some of those songs had kind of started before, but have evolved since. And then a couple of them I wrote more recently, inspired by some travel. And I curated this EP, six songs, and I kind of put them together because they felt like a really natural story and a bit of a sequence to me.
Now, I know Sadie passed a couple years ago, and she was a big part of your life. As an artist, as a performer, and, you know, someone who travels occasionally, how important is it to have, a companion of that sort who's able to come with you?
Wow, yeah, she was a really big part of the studio process. When I was living in Calgary, and I came out to Vancouver to make my first record, I didn't bring a lot of stuff with me. I still had a house back in Calgary, and I had a lot of stuff in storage, and I was a bit of a gypsy for a while, and she was a big part of my home, my consistency between a dog and an upright acoustic piano in Vancouver. It's pretty tough to find places. So I spent a lot of energy making sure that my homes could always include those things, and she was in the studio with us when we recorded Sticky Hands. She was there the whole time, and she also did a couple of solo tours with me on the road, so we would drive to Lethbridge and Calgary and maybe hit Kelowna on the way back, and she was definitely an excellent road dog, and she was a great studio dog.
I know animals have always been a big part of your life. When you were younger, there was a cat who the crazy cat who used up all of her nine lives. There was I know you had some rats. I think there was an iguana or some sort of lizard in there.
Turtles.
Hermit crabs. I know your brother had a budgie. Our brother had a budgie. What was it about animals for you that always made you want them around?
Well, I think it teaches you to care for and love something else, and an opportunity to just watch life and see other lives and other environments. Now, Rusty, who's the cat I think you were referring to, who I had for 20 years of my life, she was a very jealous pet, and she would often just unfortunately, her hunting instincts would kick in, and we quickly found that every tank pet, anything she could get her hands on, she would often claim her place and treat it like a jungle. So I lost a few pets to Rusty. She was head cat, and until we got a hedgehog, And then she realized there was finally something that she was going to have to figure out how to get along with. And then eventually Sadie, which she did get along with.
Will Rusty ever get her own album?
Rusty may get her own album. That's a good point. I actually feel like I titled my next record already, but maybe Rusty needs a song.
Well, you've got songs for Sadie. Maybe we'll have Rockin' for Rusty in the future.
Okay, yeah, I'm down. I like that.
I know at the top of the shows you mentioned your girls, the twins, which are about 3 and a half now.
Yep.
What's been the hardest part for you, you know, trying to be a working musician, but also trying to balance that with motherhood?
I think I'm a lot more exclusive with my time. I have to be. I take gigs, and when I'm traveling, I shorten it a lot more. So when I do conferences that require travel, or I'm looking at showcasing or possibly touring, it definitely takes a different consideration at this point. The studio work has actually been great. When we were doing the backing vocals, finishing up in the studio for Warning Signs, which was the single I did with Jeff Dawson, the girls were there, actually. My dad came, and we hung out, and Maya threw up all over me and in front of the mixing board, and the assistant in the studio had probably cleaned up after many bands but had no idea what to do when an eight-month-old threw up all over the client. But we've found our way, and they're picking everything up faster than I ever could have imagined, too. I'm excited for what they are also exposed to. They've been to some video shoots now. Yeah. They've seen an outdoor show. They've watched a couple of Mummy's videos.
If I'm correct, their very first concert was The Dudes.
Yes, here, actually.
Yes.
Right in... We got ear defenders for them, and it was an outdoor show here at SFU, which was fantastic because we were living just down the hill at the time, and we came up, and I got to enjoy. They put on a great show, and yeah, that was the girls' first live outdoor show, was The Dudes.
How much creative inspiration have your kids given you?
Tons.
If any, yeah.
Yeah, right from, I actually have a song that I say Sophie wrote in utero, because I wrote it when she was growing, and I definitely felt like it came from somewhere else. And she's quite a linguist. She's very articulate and already has quite a wide vocabulary. And they're very provocative right now in many ways, but... It also reminds me when they want to sit down and pick up a guitar, or Maya's really into the drums right now, and it provokes me to remember how fun instruments are and to have fun while you're playing. And so they're a great creative influence, and practicing with toddlers in the room definitely prepares you for playing in bars.
Because if they don't like it, then we'll really...
They'll just throw a sippy cup
at
your head.
Exactly,
like,
there you go.
It's over, so it teaches you to dodge objects and play with distractions and interruptions, and it's fun.
Out of the songs for Sadie, do you have a favorite song for Sadie?
Well, I think I've bounced. It's always really hard for me to choose a single because there are so many other factors to consider, not just if it's your favorite, but, you know, is it a right length and format for certain radio stations, or is it a song that's going to have a great video concept behind it? Is it something that you can play live solo if you're going to push it, promote it? But I think I'm going to take your question literally and think of it as a song for Sadie. And if I was choosing one off the album that really reminds me that I did write while she was still alive, and that I would have written with her kind of under my feet at the piano, it would probably be Cheap Junkies.
All right. Well, the album is Songs for Sadie. Jessica has her album release party April 25th at Joe's apartment. Jessica Beach, thanks.
Thank you.
And be sure to check that out every Sunday at Nat Bailey Stadium. Apologies for the little hiccups there. The looks like our program had stalled a little bit when it was up loading. But right now we have an interview with Professor Werner Arnold at the University of Heidelberg in Germany. He is the chair there. There he is the chair of the Semitic Studies Department, and he is also an expert in Western Neo-Aramaic. And I spoke with him earlier today about sort of the Aramaic language and the history surrounding that. So this is Professor Werner Arnold. On the phone with me now is Professor Werner Arnold, who is the chair of the Semitic Studies Department at Heidelberg University. Professor, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Glad to talk to you.
So you are an expert in the Aramaic language, specifically Western Neo-Aramaic. I'm curious as to how you originally became fascinated with this language.
I started studying Arabic, and I did my master thesis on Arabic dialects, and I also continued to do research in Arabic dialects. But my teacher, Professor Yastro, told me it would be good to do some other research beside Arabic, so I choose Aramaic. And in the 1980s, the situation in Syria has become a little bit better than before, and it was easier to go to Syria to do fieldwork. And so I decided to go to Malula and to live there for 2 years to learn that language and to write a grammar on that specific dialect.
Talk about your time in Malula. It seems like it's a really beautiful place.
Yes, it was at least your beautiful place until last year. Yes,
yeah.
It was a very nice place. It was considered as the most beautiful city.
Yeah. Talk about how, given Malula's location, how this language or this dialect of Aramaic has been affected by the conflict in Syria.
It has, in the first 2 years, it has not been affected very much because it was in the mountain and it was far away from the city and nobody was interested in these mountain areas. But then in the past year, an attack of this Nusra front from the north started, and they conquered all the places where Christians live, Bara and Yabrut and Deratie and Inabk. And finally, the most southern place was Malula, that was conquered in September last year. And all the people, all the Aramaeans fled, and they live now in different places in Syria, mainly in Damascus, some of them also in the Lebanon. And the village has been reconquered by the Syrian army only 1 week ago, but the situation is still too dangerous to return. So the Aramaeans still live outside the village, but they hope to go back as soon as possible.
Given sort of that migration and exodus of Maluans, coupled with, you know, the language shift of Arabic over the centuries, how in danger are we of losing this Western Neo-Aramaic?
Yeah, I think the only chance to survive for that language is that people return to their village. If they if they leave Syria and come to Europe or to the United States or Australia as the Eastern Aramean state, then there will be no chance to survive, because they will live distributed to many different countries and cities, so that they have no chance to speak with each other, and the language will have no chance. The only chance is that the people can go back to this village as soon as possible.
I read on your website that it states that Western Neo-Aramaic was the language of Christ. Given that the historical figure of Jesus lived 2,000 years ago, how certain can we be that this was the tongue that he used when communicating?
Now, Western Neo-Aramaic is the language of today. It's not the language of the time of Jesus, of course. Every
right.
language changes, and the Aramaic that is spoken today is not the language that was spoken in those days. But Jesus spoke a Western Aramaic dialect.
Okay.
And therefore, the only Western Aramaic dialect which is still spoken today is Western Neo-Aramaic in the Syrian Qalamun Mountains. All other living dialects belong to the Eastern Aramaic dialects, and they are relatively far away from that what Jesus spoke. So the dialect of Malula is the most closely related dialect to that dialect that was spoken by Jesus. It's like Latin and Italian.
Right.
Yeah.
Now,
so the language of the Italian language is the most closest language to Latin.
Right. Now, would you consider Western Aramaic a dialect, or is it a whole new language from sort of the ancient Aramaic?
Yes, we normally, when we speak of modern Aramaic dialect languages, we call them dialects. But in fact, those varieties are languages, because they cannot speak, they cannot communicate with each other. They are not mutually understandable. The Eastern and the dialect. But Western Neo-Aramaic has three dialects. That of Malula is one, and the two neighboring villages are two others. These three dialects differ a little bit from each other, but these three dialects together form the Western Neo-Aramaic language today.
I know in a lot of situations that Aramaic was displaced by Arabic, and I know you mentioned that you studied Arabic as well. I was wondering if you could talk about why a lot of the communities shifted to Arabic, but also perhaps some of the similarities between the two languages.
Yeah, Aramaic was once a little language spoken between the big languages, the Phoenician and Hebrew in the west, and the Babylonian, Assyrian in the east. But then it replaced gradually all these older languages, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Phoenician, Canaanite languages, Hebrew, so that it, in the time of Jesus, it was the most important Semitic language in that time. But then, when Islam spread from the north, from the Arabic Peninsula to the north, Aramaic was replaced by Arabic greatly. First of all, in the cities, in the big cities, Damascus and Beirut, and then from the 14th century on, also in the small villages. And it survived only in remote areas in the mountains. Western Neo-Aramaic on the border in Syria, on the border to Lebanon, and the Eastern Aramaic dialects in Turkey and in Iraq and in Iran. So that we have today only small islands of Aramaic that remained until the very day.
I know there's a couple of organizations out there that are trying to sort of save Aramaic, or at least revive interest in the language. I think there's actually one in Damascus at the university. Can you talk about those at all?
Yeah, in the 1990s, or even in the 80s, the people felt that that the language has no prestige if the language has no writing system. So they started to think about writing the language, which was always a not written language in Malula, because the language of the church and of introduction was once Greek, because yeah. They belonged to the Greek Orthodox Church. And so there is a teacher of English from Malula. His name is Georges Ruscalla, and he started together with some professors from the university in Damascus to develop a writing system. And they recommended to use the script, the Aramaic script that is used, that was used by the Jews and is now used to write Hebrew in modern Israel. So this project was supported by the government, and they erected an Aramaic language institute, and Georges Ruscalla studied to teach Aramaic there, mainly for children of Malulan origin who live now in Damascus. And he taught these characters, and the people there, the children started to learn this language. And that took place until the city was occupied by the Nusra Front.
Given that it's been stated that, you know, Jesus spoke a dialect of Aramaic, but we don't really see that with any, you know, mass greatness in the modern Bible, how accurate would you say scripture is today compared to what Jesus might have, you know, Jesus and his followers might have said 2,000 years ago? Can we know for sure?
No, we cannot know it for sure, because we do not know the Aramaic dialect of the Galilee where Jesus was born. We have more information about the southern Jewish Aramaic dialects in Jerusalem and the surroundings of Jerusalem. But there are some sentences in the Gospels not translated into Greek when Jesus spoke, and we know from that sentences that he normally spoke with the people Aramaic, and that must have been that Aramaic that was spoken by the Jews in that time. The Samaritans spoke a little bit different dialect.
Well, it's a fascinating area of discussion, and I definitely think it's something more people should be aware of. I just want to, before we go, I want to throw our listeners' attention to Thezer, or raem.eu/Malula, where you can find out about how Malula was attacked by extremist rebels and how to act now. It's in English, Syrian, and in German. Professor Werner Arnold, thank you so much for your time today.
It was my pleasure. Have a nice day.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Werner Arnold, professor of Semitic Studies at Heidelberg University and an expert on Western Neo-Aramaic, and I reached him in Heidelberg. This has been Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. As well, we are on the internet at cjsf.ca, and of course, you can always listen to us on TELUS HD Channel 7014. I want to thank Professor Werner Arnold for being here today. I want to thank Jay Perini. His new book is Jesus, the Human Face of God. You can visit him at jperini.com. And of course, Jessica Beach, whose new album is Songs for Sadie, jessicabeachmusic.com. And she has her CD release party Thursday, April 25th at Joe's Apartment downtown on Granville Street. Be sure to tune next week when my guest will be viral video sensation Jesse Perrant, author of To the Boys Who Will One Day Date My Daughter, as well as photographer Isadora Kosofsky. We are going to take you out with Jessica's song, Cheap Junkies, and we will see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Could it be you? Advertising here, yeah, could it be you? I just need someone near me, 'cause it's been a while, but I can't stop trying. It's been a while, and I'll take you home tonight, even if you're lying. Tonight, even if you're lying.